Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, building smarter and stronger. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. When the eye of Hurricane Irma first made landfall in Florida, Hacklett Lane on Cudjoe Key was one of the first streets to experience it. Hacklett Lane is on the southern tip of Cudjoe, where the Key juts out into the Atlantic Ocean and curls slightly westward, creating Cudjoe Bay. At 1185 Hacklett stands a 2.5-story home with gray siding. It's built on pilings, with the living space beginning up a flight of stairs in the back corner. When I visited last week, the owners had just arrived, driving down from their primary home in St. Petersburg. They had bought this house in 2014. It had been 9 days since their vacation home first encountered Irma. I spoke with Sue, who didn't want to give her last name. This was where the eye first came ashore in Florida. This is your home here in the Keys. You've owned it for 3 years. Tell me what you encountered when you returned today.
We had seen pictures from NOAA of the roof, so we knew there was roof damage. Our neighbor came to check on his property that he's building on, and we knew there was some siding gone. When we went inside the home, we realized part of the roof was down, and there was a little water damage down a couple of walls. But, you know, for the most part, we're very lucky.
Sue and her husband were lucky. The home was still standing, and they do not think it suffered any major damage. Some of the siding was peeled back, as she said, and they had a relatively small roof leak. All the stuff they stored under the home was ruined. A toaster oven, a second refrigerator, washer dryer, a couch, other stuff. Those all victims of Irma's storm surge. But the home itself appeared to perform just as it was designed to when it was built in 1989.
We are so thrilled that it withstood what obviously went through here.
But that's not true for others on Cudjoe Key and elsewhere throughout the Keys, especially homes not built up on pilings, and for mobile homes. They were no match for Irma's destructive Category 4 winds, heavy rains, and storm surge. Among the factors making the difference between minor damage and destruction, homes built to updated building codes. Sue, her husband, and their high school-age son waited out Irma at their home in St. Pete. They had lost power before the eye hit Cudjoe, so they didn't know right away that their Keys house sat directly in Irma's eyewall path. When they did learn,
I said to my husband, well, let's just assume everything is gone, and then we'll be pleasantly surprised when we get there.
7.5 miles away on Little Torch Key lives Phil Wainick. He had his generator running. The debris pile across the street was already 4 feet high when I visited him last week. It included a chest freezer, mini fridge, and other things that he had stored on his first floor of his home.
When I saw my house still standing, I didn't care how much damage there was. I was totally ecstatic. I really was. Driving through and seeing some of the devastation, seeing houses that used to be on the south side of the road, sitting on the north side of the road, my heart sank, and I feel for all of them. And when I got here and saw my house standing, I was like, it was almost like a kid on Christmas.
Phil's home is a two-story house that sits 3 stories high since it's built up on pilings. It was constructed in 1994. Phil bought it 3 years ago.
Unbelievable landscaping, nice two-story house, very few two-story houses down here. Nice clean canal that flows without grass and weed in it. So I was pretty much sold at that point.
Walk me through.
Sure.
Show me around.
So the front side here, the only real damage looks like some water got in behind the cement board and kind of created a little bit of swelling on the cement board here. Everything withstood the wind here, but this was not the wind side. We come around here, you'll see the damage that starts taking place and how fast it starts deteriorating. You can see all the faces ripped off there and starting to miss some soffit down here.
We're on the south side of your building now, right?
Yes, this will be the south side. When we get to the east, this is where she crumbles. Come to the east side, and you can see all the soffit, all the faces missing. The roofs are missing off of the deck. All the screens are missing off of the porches, both porches. And you can see all the railings were completely wiped out.
We are just, 3 miles or so from Ramrod, just a handful of miles from Cudjoe, which is where the center of the eye crossed at 9:10, I think it was, that Monday morning. So you were really on that dirty side of the storm here. You're right off the canal.
Yes, sir. And as, I mean, you can see this is definitely the southeast side is what took it, because when we walk around the other side and go to the north, you can see very little damage right here. We did lose our electrical head, but that was due to, you know, some trees over on the other side there that pulled it off the wall, but we got it back up, so.
Just concentrated right on that southeast corner. Absolutely. Right where that wind and that wind-driven rain really hit. What about water damage in the house?
The downstairs enclosure had water up to here.
About, 2.5 feet high, 3 feet
definitely
high?
Probably 3 feet high. I can show you a water line on the shed also. That has probably the most predominant water line.
And this would have been storm surge here, because you're right on the canal. So salt water. Oh, yeah, there it is. Right up to the door handle on your storage shed. Storage shed looked like it shifted a little bit, too, here.
I had it roped together, and that was the only thing that kept it there. Otherwise, she would be gone. Or it might have taken the whole deck out, actually. But, yeah, I had it all fastened down with rope, and it shifted, but it stayed where it needed to stay and not do any damage.
Can we go inside the house?
Sure.
Do you mind? Show us around.
Just be careful without any railings up there.
So you had everything shuttered up before you left, is that right?
I had everything shuttered up. Like the Bahama shutters, you can actually leave like that, but I don't. We buttoned them all the way down. I mean, they needed to be buttoned down. I mean, this was a bad one coming for us. As you can see, it's total clutter in here, because everything that used to be on the deck, we needed to get off of the deck and put in here. I mean, there's a kayak in my dining room, as you can see, because you don't want that floating away.
You knew when you were away, and I'm sure you're keeping pace with that storm, and you knew when the National Hurricane Center said landfall, eye of Irma, Cudjoe Key. I'm guessing you knew exactly how many miles that was away from your home.
We actually, my girlfriend and I were sitting on my father's porch, and I was calculating, have my GPS coordinates written down of the house, and we're calculating it, and I'm like, great, right now it's exactly 1 mile south of us, and it's 3 miles west of us. And I was just like, oh man, this is not good. But she fared out. Like I said, I mean, at least I still have a house. I mean, it's been a lot of cleanup, a lot of damage. I've lost a lot of money on all this, but you know what? I still have a home, and that's all that matters.
Phil Wainick's home on Little Torch Key survived Irma thanks to how it was built. It was made with hurricanes in mind. Still to come as our program continues, keeping up building standards in the Keys as it begins to rebuild.
If anyone drives the lower Keys, they will clearly see why we have to maintain that level. And I know it's expensive, but if you want to live in paradise, you're going to have to sacrifice for that safety.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, building smarter and stronger. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening to WLRN. About 1,200 homes in the Lower Keys suffered major damage or were destroyed by Hurricane Irma. That's the early assessment from last week by the county, thanks to what first responders encountered in the days after the storm. Another 500-plus are uninhabitable in the Upper Keys. Christine Hurley is the assistant administrator for Monroe County. She's responsible for planning and building throughout the Keys.
Metal roofs are the bomb. They hold up. If they have anything, it's because someone added a carport and maybe disturbed that seal that goes around the edge. Barrel tiles are the next strongest type of roof, and then shingles are last. Older versus newer was clearly an asset to have a newer home. In 1992 is when the building codes changed after Andrew. And we're familiar with our new projects because we have such small amount of new construction. So the roofs that were new, amazing. Concrete versus wood, concrete held up. Interestingly, modular units, which we build a lot of down here because concrete is so expensive, a lot of our providers do modular installations on stilts. They look solid from the structural point of view, but the cosmetics generally on the outside are pretty torn up. Siding is off. You can see insulation.
Describe what those newer homes and what those building codes have done for those homes that were built with those codes in mind.
I think those homes are livable. I think people can come back, and once they get their electric and their water and sewer finalized and hooked up, they'll be moving back into those homes. You know, they'll have some improvements to make, but unfortunately, the older ones or the ones below flood, they're going to have to find alternative solutions.
What does it tell you about the code in Monroe County versus Irma?
I think it's good. I think the state of Florida has done an incredible job maintaining those strong building codes. They passed the code. We can no longer amend it. I've been in this field over 25 years, and I remember building officials could amend the code. We could amend it locally, and we could do whatever we wanted if we had the political will. The state having such a strong stance has helped us do our jobs locally.
It's also made the building more expensive, certainly, but has that return on investment been seen in a case like this?
So I can assure you that prior to this storm, our construction industry had angst about some of the strict rules that we have. It is expensive to build down here, and that creates an affordable housing problem. And they all know that. They have workers. They want their people to be able to go into homes and live here for our community to have good backbone. If anyone drives the Lower Keys, they will clearly see why we have to maintain that level. And I know it's expensive, but if you want to live in paradise, you're going to have to sacrifice for that safety.
On the flood side, the National Flood Insurance Program is broke and has been broke, frankly, since Katrina for 12 years. Congress is going to have to continue to allow borrowing to happen for the recovery to happen here in the Keys. But there's also a concern about the repetitive loss issue. How should the Keys be thinking about that for those older homes that are in floodplains, have been wiped out, will be declared disasters, and are insured?
I'm really lucky because about a year ago, our county commission let me hire a consultant to study repetitive loss. Our goal was to proactively address repetitive loss. And then we also retained an employee who helped rebuild New Jersey after Sandy, accessing all the different kinds of grant monies for repetitive loss properties. Well, now we have the whole inventory of repetitive loss documented. We know exactly where they are. It is confidential information. You are not allowed to share that with the public, one of the few protected items.
But the county knows these repetitive loss properties. Do the property owners know their repetitive loss properties?
It depends, because if they were a new buyer and the loss was under a prior, they would not know. So part of the reason that we have to do the flood inspections is FEMA will not give you your flood insurance money unless you're going to get build back to code and elevate the home. So we know repetitive loss, we know where they're located, and our computer system is fully set up to know when someone comes in for a permit, you know, how to handle that. That we're ahead of the curve on. What is next, though, and critical to the county, and I was in New Jersey about a month ago at a seminar for this, is how to request public assistance. Right now we're in first phase of recovery, damage and debris and all that, but the next phases are important because we're hoping we can leverage federal money to help rebuild the neighborhoods and elevate the homes. I even got to do a tour of a neighborhood where you could see the few homes that survived and how they were all elevated with the grant money. I believe the community we visited got about $200 million to work on that project alone.
There may be Monroe County homeowners whose homes were destroyed because of floodwaters, and they have national flood insurance, but they don't know they are repetitive loss. And until they pull that permit, then they'll know that they need to build up several feet, perhaps, if they want to put their home back.
Well, but they would have to do it anyway, regardless if it was repetitive. If their home was damaged more than 50%, they're going to need to rebuild at the current floodplain regulations.
This is going to reshape the coastline to some degree for those neighborhoods, isn't it?
It is. Some of our neighborhoods have already transitioned into that. You can drive the Keys. But the older areas, when I drove some of the more damaged areas, more of the commercial struck me, believe it or not, because little places like Mangrove Mamas, Snappers, the really cultural icons we have here are destroyed. Now, commercial can floodproof. So, but they won't have that weird Keezy, Keishy, you know, personality why we're all here. I think that's going to be a challenge to maintain.
So as the person kind of responsible for rebuilding the Keys to some degree, it's going to go through your office, right?
Right.
How can the Keys harden itself further?
Actually, I think private structures will be okay relative to following the new codes when they rebuild. It will be much more resilient. I think there's going to be challenges when we get to neighborhoods where infrastructure was designed relative to the scale and the elevation of the private structures. We have a sustainability director, and she had already been modeling and dealing with certain neighborhoods with sea level rise and how...
Meaning sewer and water lines, for instance, already drainage. Drainage being inundated on sunny day flooding, those kinds of things.
Correct. Correct.
What kind of investments do you think need to be made so that when the next Irma, or Wilma for that matter, come through, that it's even in better shape perhaps than what it was with this storm?
I think the storm will challenge the county as far as resources related to the manpower to actually document this. I think the hardest part for the Keys is going to be how slowly we can even issue permits and give people what they need to start rebuilding. That's the biggest challenge I see right now. To put a dollar figure on it, I can't.
Christine Hurley is responsible for planning and building in Monroe County. Now, mobile homes are an important part of the housing stock in the Keys. They make up a good portion of the homes for people who live and work in the Keys year-round. The county expects most of the 7,500 mobile homes are uninhabitable.
I'm praying that some private entrepreneur comes up with a tiny home solution that is resilient. I read about that all the time. Before this happened, we were constantly poring over documents related to that. And I've seen some. I'm not positive they can meet the 180 mile an hour wind requirement, but they can be elevated. So I'm really hoping that even our state, like the Building Officials Association, will invest, because this isn't just in the Keys. A lot of Florida now is damaged this way. And it would behoove them to come up with a solution that's more resilient than a regular mobile home.
But as the head of the building department in Monroe County, you can say that mobile homes will be back in Monroe County.
They are not legally disallowed. They're not illegal. It's not illegal to add a mobile home to the county.
Christine Hurley, responsible for planning and building in Monroe County as the assistant administrator for the county. Still to come, using lessons of the past to invest before another storm.
If you look at the cost of disasters, it's simply not sustainable. We're talking about tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars just in the last handful of storms we've had.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Today, we're talking about building smarter and stronger after Hurricane Irma. In 1992, R. David Paulison was the fire rescue chief of Miami-Dade County. He witnessed firsthand the destructive force of a major hurricane. Andrew tore apart entire subdivisions, some with homes only a few years old. The wholesale destruction of neighborhoods led to building code reforms in South Florida and statewide. Studies found homes built in the 1980s and early 90s suffered worse than older homes because codes had been relaxed throughout the years before Andrew. In 1994, 2 years after that big storm, new, stricter codes became effective. They included requiring thicker plywood, impact-resistance glass, and roof truss tie-downs. Fast forward 2 decades, when Hurricane Charley barreled into southwest Florida as a Category 4 storm, a subsequent study found homes built before 1996 suffered an average loss of $24 per square foot. Homes built after 1996 and the newer updated post-Andrew building codes suffered an average loss of $14 per square foot. 13 months later, in 2005, in the days after Hurricane Katrina, which flooded New Orleans, Paulison was named administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He's credited with reforming and strengthening the agency. Today, Paulison lives in Broward County.
We had a lot of homes that failed during Hurricane Andrew that perhaps should not have failed. Some of them were brand new homes, even in areas like Country Walk, which was an upscale neighborhood. So we looked very carefully at what failed and why did these buildings fail. And what we learned was if we can protect the envelope of the building, the windows and doors, tie the roof down properly, have the right types of materials on the roof, that these buildings will withstand quite a bit of wind, you know, 130, 40 miles an hour. So we worked hard, and Charlie Danger, who was in charge of our building department at the time, we pushed very hard with the legislature to deal with the home builders who were not supportive of this at the time, to change these codes and push them through the legislature at the state level. And we did that. The code is different from Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County than it is in the rest of the state, but the entire state has a high wind velocity types of building codes that have served us very well.
And Florida is unique in that regard about having at least a minimum statewide building standard, isn't it?
There's a couple states that have done a really good job of looking at the types of natural disasters, catastrophic events, if you will, and have changed their codes. California is another one. Now, they're not necessarily dealing with the high wind velocities that we are, but they do deal with earthquakes. So they retrofitted their buildings and changed their building codes to deal with earthquakes. They've also changed their building codes to deal with wildfires. You can't have wood shingle roofs anymore. You have to have a defensible space around you. So there are other states who have done that. But there's only 16 or so states in this country that have statewide building codes that are enforceable.
In affordable housing constrained South Florida, doesn't that make housing that much more expensive and perhaps beyond the reach of working folks?
It does not. It does not push the cost up that much. I mean, you change the type of roof you put on. Instead of press board, we're using plywood. Instead of just regular nails, we use ring shank nails. The nails have to be put in closer together than we did in the past. So, you know, that's an insignificant amount of money to do that. You know, the roofs are strapped down all the way from the tie beam all the way down to the footing. The windows are fastened in differently instead of just being screwed into the wood bucks like we used to do. Now it's screwed all the way into the block and it's poured with concrete. The doors are done the same way. Instead of the doors swinging out, they have to swing in. So the wind is pushing against the door jamb instead of pushing just to an empty door. So those types of things are insignificant costs. And with the housing stock and the fastest home sell in South Florida, I don't see it putting the price range out of hardly anybody.
What would be the return on investment for these kinds of building codes to go national or at least in states that tend to either be coastal or have a prevalence of natural disasters, hurricanes or otherwise?
Well, if you look at the cost of disasters, it's simply not sustainable. We're talking about tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, just in the last handful of storms we've had, from Wilma and Sandy, Harvey, and now Irma and Maria. It's just not sustainable. We have to design to do better mitigation up front, to design our buildings to withstand these types of natural events, whatever they are, and wherever you happen to be in the country, because it's going to change. To reduce those costs on the backside. We are spending 14 times more money on the disaster side than we are on the pre-disaster side. And just look how much money we could save if we designed our homes to withstand these types of storms. And so you don't have that cost on the backside. Just look at the Keys. Look at the Florida Keys, a direct hit from a Category 4. And if you look at those homes that had the new building codes that were designed by those really strong building codes in Monroe County, they did well despite the fact they took a direct hit. And the ones that were in the old code, they're pretty much gone. So look at the money that's going to save. Now you have a home with minimal damage as opposed to a home that's been totally destroyed. So it does pay off in the long run.
How does this fit in with disaster aid and disaster relief? As a former administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, you toured the country deciding and doling out federal aid. Is there a lack of incentive on the front-end investment that you're talking about here in terms of building codes and building inspections versus waiting for the disaster and for the aid that invariably comes?
I think it's more of a, and I'll say this kindly, a political intestinal fortitude to be able to stand up and say, no, we are going to change our building codes and we're going to do it best based on X, Y, and Z, X, Y, and Z being the type of catastrophic events we know we're going to have. And we're going to push against our home builders. We're going to push against other people. And we're going to put these codes in place to better protect the residents that we're sworn to protect. That's why they get elected. And they have to stand up and make those tough decisions. And if they don't, maybe we need to do something differently. Maybe we should be rewarding those states that put strong building codes in place and we don't have to spend as much money. And maybe we should have a disincentive for the states who refuse to do that.
Dave, when you were the fire rescue chief in Miami-Dade after Hurricane Andrew, I can't imagine there was much talk, if any, about climate change and sea level rise and the influence on the size and strength of Andrew. Here we are 25 years later, and we're having those kinds of discussions. Are there lessons to be learned with the response on building codes to the disaster of Andrew that perhaps could be applicable for rising seas and other climate change challenges that we face?
I think there is. I think those lessons learned in Andrew, and whether if you take the politics out of yes, we have climate change or no, we don't, it doesn't matter. It only takes one hurricane to have you give you a really bad day. So if we start planning for those events that we know we're going to have, and here in South Florida, it's very predictable for us. We know what we're going to have. If you go to California, they know they're going to have earthquakes. If you go to Texas and Oklahoma, they know they're going to have hurricanes. You go up into the Midwest, they know they're going to have flooding. And we start planning for those and do our mitigation plans up front to mitigate that amount of damage, then we're all going to be better off. So for whatever you say is causing the hurricanes, I mean, I grew up here, my dad grew up here, so we've had hurricanes, forever. And is climate change causing them? I that's hard to say because we've always had them. Are they getting bigger? We've had some pretty big ones in the 30s and 60s. So I'm just saying, let's just be very pragmatic about this whole approach. What types of disasters can we predict we're going to have, and what do we do to plan for them? And if we do that, if we really do that, we're going to put people in a good place to ride these out, and their home's going to stay intact, or your home's not going to flood, and then we're going to be better off in the long run.
Former FEMA Administrator R. David Paulison. Still to come, building stronger and smarter for a changing climate.
We don't want to be Detroit or a Rust Belt, the equivalent of a Rust Belt city, which didn't see it coming, and even when it was happening, sat on their hands and didn't do anything about the economic factors that were driving their decline.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. There is absolute scale to measure hurricanes, the categories meteorologists use. Then there's the relative scale that the rest of us use. Was it better or worse than a different storm? And those storms we use to compare tend to have happened in the last generation or so. Some of that comparison is because our memories tend to be short, and so many of us have moved to South Florida since the last big storm. But some of it also is because of the development of the region, which has been so significant that comparing damage from one storm of the pre-air conditioning days just pales in economic scale. Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg has been an architect in South Florida for more than 30 years and professor at the University of Miami. She's been a leading voice on urban design and climate resiliency.
Compared to several others that I've experienced before this, I think it looks very good. We could have had much greater loss of buildings and infrastructure. The building code improvements that have been made since Andrew, and a number of things we've been attending to, including the recovery efforts of the utilities, are very different than many years ago. Now, there's, of course, many things that we could learn from. We had a tremendous amount of landscape loss. I think we've stopped taking care of our landscape in preparation for storms. We used to do that some decades ago. So we can learn from that, and probably the utilities will adjust their plans as well.
A lot of the credit for the lack of damage goes to, obviously, the storm path moving to the west of Miami. But as you look at the community, have there been hardening or resiliency efforts that were tested in Irma that seem to have passed this initial test, this first major storm that we've had in 12 years?
I think it's visible in the buildings, this in particular the storm windows, the hurricane force glass that now many buildings have. You saw many fewer shutters up, and relatively small amounts of breakage. So I think that's clearly visible. I can't help thinking also of an image I saw of Puerto Rico, where the next hurricane just passed, and a total destruction in the foreground and a six-story glass building in the background intact. So clearly building codes can help.
The big lesson after Andrew was a building code and significant changes to those codes. What are some of the lessons as an urban planner you'll be looking for from Irma?
I cannot help but make comparisons with prior events, as well as Katrina in Mississippi and Louisiana. And there was a time after these events that, as urban planners and designers, we would look upon opportunities for rebuilding better than what we had done. And that had something to do with the fact that it was totally destroyed, those places. After Irma, we didn't have the kind of destruction that you might look at a place and say, is there something we can do better when we build it back? Because it's still standing. So I think there are no big picture ideas. Perhaps one is that transportation was an issue, and developing some ideas about in cases of catastrophe or emergency, how transportation works. It's a utility, just like electricity and communications.
Is this regarding evacuation orders, those kinds of things?
Well, I think evacuation is one of the issues, but also just getting around afterwards. I think the evacuation question, the evacuation orders are to some degree questionable. How can you evacuate the whole peninsula was the big question. Many of us decided to remain in place, but we needed to be able to get around afterwards. And I think that's about setting up a plan that sets up priorities. We might imagine that this is training for future experiences, but other kinds of adaptation. So studying those scenarios based on this experience would be important.
The experience of Irma has shown a spotlight again on the ability to mitigate and respond and adapt, and the necessity for that in some cases. And here we are just, a couple of weeks after Hurricane Irma, and we're getting the king tides again and the dry day flooding, for instance, in some of our lower parts. How could Irma influence the thinking about resiliency and adaptation in South Florida?
Well, there are I think there are three steps to think about, or three kinds of evolving scenarios to consider for resiliency and adaptation. And one is, the first one is living with whatever's happening. So one of, you mentioned mitigation and recovery, but there's that period of it's happening, we're hunkered down, we need food and water, and then there's 2 or 3 days before anybody can really get to us or we can get anywhere, and we have to take care of ourselves entirely. That's the living with it period. And we will be living with flooding, as you're seeing with the king tide question. That's living with it until you can do something to get out of it. And then there's the adapting of saying, all right, now it's time to raise the streets. And that's a kind of recovery mode. And then the third one is to say, you know, we've had it, we can't deal with this, and I'm moving to North Carolina or whatever, or we have to move out of the lowland.
So, the retreat, in other retreat. Words.
Yeah. So some people prefer to call it relocation, by the way.
But we're not there as a community. We're not retreating. We're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars of public investment in pumps. We're seeing the city of Miami asking voters to approve hundreds of millions of dollars of new borrowing for pumps and other mitigation. We're seeing that in neighborhoods in Broward County, those kinds of things. So it's not retreating, it's reinforcing is where this community seems to be right now.
And that that's perfectly correct. That's the correct first thing to do. We have to send the signal that we're going to do something about what's happening to us. And in particular, that's important psychologically, economically, many, many reasons. But at some point, people will start asking, who's getting the benefit of that extra cost, and how will these changes be allocated in a much more critical fashion than I think we're accustomed to thinking about the public budget?
The return on investment that would be necessary for the kind of private and public dollars to reinforce and to rethink how South Florida is still to exist in the next half century or so. How do we think about that today?
We don't want to be Detroit or a Rust Belt, the equivalent of a Rust Belt city, which didn't see it coming, and even when it was happening, sat on their hands and didn't do anything about the economic factors that were driving their decline. So we understand what the factors are, and we may not know how to deal with them yet, but we can figure it out. There's a kind of cost benefit that all of us probably engage when we say, looking back, it's been about every dozen years that there's some major event that's an interruption for anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks for many of us. And on the balance, we're willing to do that. And that's a kind of thinking that maybe the timing is accelerated. It may be more frequent than 12 years that we have to deal with issues. Or as the people who deal with flooding in their streets, they're learning how to live with that. And I dare say that that's going to be true not only for our region, but other parts of the country, whether it's fires or mudslides or river flooding, that in some ways we have more extreme conditions that we learn. We can learn how to live with as well as try to deal with in the long term.
Architect Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg. She is the former dean of the University of Miami's School of Architecture. Still to come, grading the infrastructure in the Sunshine State. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. Building or shoring up your home against what Mother Nature can throw at it is one thing, but what about streets, bridges, and water systems? Life and business depend on these types of infrastructure, and Florida's grade for many of these is not great. Jose Acosta is a vice president at engineering firm Chenmore & Associates. He helped lead the Florida section of the American Society of Civil Engineers Infrastructure Report Card in 2016 and joins us now here in studio. Jose, welcome to the Sunshine Economy. Nice to see you.
Good to meet you.
Florida's worst grade in your report card was a D-plus for coastal areas, those most at risk of hurricanes. Why the D grade for coastal areas in the Sunshine State?
Well, the Sunshine State has 825 miles of sandy beaches, and the truth of the matter is funding, the amount of effort that's needed to keep our beaches looking the way they do and addressing all the different infrastructure issues is a funding effort that just isn't there across the state. You see efforts here in South Florida on a regular basis with some of our municipalities and our counties and in some of our districts, but it's just not enough for the scale of effort that we need because of our changing times.
The beach areas in Florida kind of present two assets for us. One is the tourism, of course, and the draw for the number one industry in the state. The second one, however, is a real natural buffer against storm surge and hurricanes. And both of those, in your report card, you're saying are malinvested. We're just not seeing enough state and federal resources pushed into the beaches.
If you see the effects even now during Irma, throughout the coastline, as far as the constant push of the coastline, whether through Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, some of those pictures we all saw, those folks suffering, yeah. The dollars that are required to try to move and restore those on a regular basis really cause some major issues beyond the infrastructure that's needed to keep it. To be able to move the beach back, to be able to have the wetland mitigation areas, some of the different types of things that assist us in slowing down those efforts.
You found in the report card that over the past decade, the average difference between requested and state appropriated funds exceeded $40 million per year. So local governments are asking for this money from the state. The money is not coming. Where would that money go? What's not being invested in when it comes to the coastal areas?
What they're trying to do is to try to make do with what they can. Most South Florida cities and coastal areas are trying to do stormwater master plans, are also looking at some of the environmental impacts to see what can be done. You see it here in Miami Beach, you see it elsewhere, and they're each trying to do it on a local basis as well on a macro basis. But when you have storms and some of these climate events come before us, what happens is those monies then get diverted to some of these things that some of these emergency efforts that we're talking about. Along with that, there isn't a commitment as much as we'd like at the state level and at the federal level to fund coastal. And that's where the message to the public and the message to our politicians needs to be to continue to through the report card. Mm-hmm. Through some of these efforts to understand it tangibly how it affects our economy.
You talked about stormwater there. We've seen significant municipal investments with flood pump stations in Miami Beach, for instance. The city of Miami will be asking voters to approve $400 million for a bond referendum, half of which will go to stormwater mitigation efforts. You give the state of Florida a D. Have these public investments that have been made, is it good money spent? Is it a good return on investment?
It is. The concern is the state of Florida, because stormwater is part of our everyday, especially here in South Florida, where we have the five water management districts and the local drainage districts and the cities all involved. But the scale of need that is at such a large level that we struggle to get the funding we need to from a federal standpoint and then keep it growing. Remember, we're growing, we're expanding, the development's expanding. Therefore, you don't have the storage areas. Right. You hear the 100-year storm at all times. So but, folks don't understand that, and we need to do a better job of explaining the need to the public to justify the funding.
So when we're seeing a $500 million investment on behalf of Miami Beach for its pump stations and raising streets, $200 million being requested for new borrowing dedicated to stormwater and flood mitigation efforts in the city of Miami, is this kind of local spending sustainable if the state dollars and federal dollars aren't coming in?
It is an investment. In Miami Beach's case, there are their needs. Folks want to come. It is the one of the places to go in our beautiful state. So there is a justification for those residents and for those commercial businesses to keep it going. Now, at some point, that overall master plan, that analysis to see where the where the warranted infrastructure should go is currently being done by the folks in Miami Beach and beyond. But as City of Miami, as you just mentioned, is trying to do, is also trying to put out their stormwater master plan. It's important that whilst we do the short term, that we look at the long term and see what those costs are, so we can have the appropriate conversation what things cost, so that again we go to DC, we go to Tallahassee and ask for what's appropriate and see what that buys the public.
You're looking for that investment up front to shore up against storms, but to some degree, what you've been experiencing when it comes to beach replenishment and whatnot is the willingness of governments to spend the money after the fact. Is that a good use of public dollars?
Well, what happens after a storm is it becomes the relevant topic, and it's why we're having a conversation on the radio today.
Right.
It's important to keep that message going of the importance of resiliency, and I think we need to do a bit to be able to explain it to the public in ways that they can chew and understand of the scale of importance. Yeah. As in the Netherlands, for example, the scale of effort they do and they spend on stormwater.
Has Florida been adequately investing in public infrastructure to shore up against the threat of a major hurricane, the kind of threat that Irma posed?
The answer overall is no. That said, Florida invests more than most states because this is our way of life. The water table is as close as it is. It's part of our daily designs that we do professionally in our industry. But again, the scale of growth, the scale of capacity, the changing tides, all of those things come into place where we need to up our game significantly.
What would be the number one priority for public investment and infrastructure-wise for you?
It's real in my mind, it's resiliency in the coast and stormwater.
Coastal investment.
That said, water and sewer for another time is as important.
Jose Acosta is with us, Vice President and engineering firm Chen Moore & Associates. He helped lead the Florida section of the American Society of Civil Engineers Infrastructure Report Card for the state of Florida. Jose, thanks for joining us today on the Sunshine Economy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael Stock is our technical director. You can catch more online at WLRN.org. You can also follow us on social media at WLRN on Twitter. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.